Picture this. It is a morning in the spring of 1921, a grass airfield on the northern coast of France. An engine is warming up somewhere nearby. That bark and snarl of a French aero motor on a cold morning, and the smell of castor oil is on everything. A young woman from Waxahachie, Texas, climbs into the cockpit. She crossed an ocean to get here, because nobody in America would teach her to fly. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about Bessie Coleman, and if you don't know that name, pull up a chair. This is a story about what it means to want something so completely that an ocean becomes a stepping stone instead of a wall. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Bessie Coleman was born on January 26, 1892, in Atlanta, Texas, not Atlanta, Georgia, Atlanta, Texas, a small town in Cass County in the northeast corner of the state. She was one of 13 children. Her father, George Coleman, was part Choctaw Indian. Her mother, Susan Coleman, was African American. In the American South at the turn of the century, that combination meant a life lived under layers of legal and social restriction that would be difficult for many of us to fully imagine today. The family moved to Waxahachie when Bessie was 2 years old. Her father eventually left for Indian Territory in Oklahoma, hoping to find better standing under Choctaw citizenship. Susan Coleman stayed behind to raise the children alone. She worked as a domestic servant. The children, Bessie included, picked cotton to bring in money. They were sharecroppers in the Texas heat. Long rows, long days, and not much at the end of either. But Susan Coleman would not let schooling slip. She walked those children to the schoolhouse, and she meant it. Bessie absorbed everything the school had to offer. She was sharp and quick with numbers, and she knew it. She saved enough money, dollar by dollar, to attend the Colored Agricultural and Normal University in Langston, Oklahoma, which is today Langston University. She made it through one semester before the money ran out. She went home, a lesser person stops there. Bessie Coleman took a train to Chicago. It was 1915. Two of her brothers were already in the city. Chicago in the years of the Great Migration was alive with energy. Black Americans were flooding north from the South in enormous numbers, looking for factory work, looking for something less than the constant grinding machinery of Jim Crow. Chicago was not paradise by any definition, but it was different. There was space to breathe. Bessie found work as a manicurist at the White Sox barbershop on South State Street. She was good at her work. She was good with people. She saved. She paid attention. Then the war ended. Her brothers John and Walter came home from France with the rest of the expeditionary force in 1919. Like a lot of returning veterans, they talked about what they had seen, and they talked about flying. John Coleman, the story goes, had a particular habit of telling Bessie that French women were learning to fly, which was more than could be said for her. It was a brotherly tease. It became the single most consequential thing anyone ever said to her. Bessie Coleman decided she was going to be a pilot. She started applying to flight schools. The Curtis School, the most prominent in the country, had operations in Illinois. She applied, turned down. She applied to schools in other states, turned down every single one. The reason was never stated in clean legal language, but the reality was total inconsistent. No American flight school in 1919 or 1920 would accept a student who was black, female, or both. In Bessie Coleman's case, it was always both. She could have concluded that the world had made its position clear and adjusted her ambitions accordingly. That would have been the rational response. She did not make the rational response. She went to see Robert Abbott. Abbott was a major figure in black American life. He had founded the Chicago Defender in 1905, and by 1919 it had become the most widely read black newspaper in the country. It was read in barbershops and church halls from Chicago to New Orleans. In some southern cities it was distributed quietly by railroad porters because certain towns had made it effectively illegal to possess. Abbott was not just a publisher, he was a man with reach, with connections, and with a long view. He was also genuinely captivated by aviation. He had written editorials arguing that flight was transformative and that black Americans needed to be part of it, not as spectators but as pilots and builders and participants. He had conviction on the subject. He listened to Bessie Coleman and he told her to go to France. France had been ahead of the United States on questions of race for decades. African American artists, musicians, and veterans had been finding a degree of personal freedom in Paris that was simply unavailable at home, and the French aviation schools had no policy, written or unwritten, against teaching a woman or a black woman or anyone else who showed up with the tuition money and the will to learn. But she would have to speak French to get there. Bessie Coleman spent months in Chicago studying French with teachers she found in the community. Think about the discipline that required. She was still working full days at the barbershop. She was saving every extra dollar. and in the evening she was drilling French grammar and vocabulary, because on the other side of that language barrier was the cockpit that her own country had denied her. She crossed the Atlantic in November of 1920. She enrolled at the École d'Aviation des Frères Caudron, the school run by the Caudron brothers, at Le Crotoy on the coast of Picardy where the Somme meets the sea. The Caudron brothers had been building and flying since the earliest days of powered aviation. Their school sat on flat land near the estuary. The North Sea weather in winter was not gentle. The machines she learned on were typical of the era. Open cockpit biplanes, fabric over a frame of spruce and ash wire bracing humming in the slipstream. No gyroscopic instruments, no radio, no navigational aids, except a compass and what you could see out of the cockpit. The stall characteristics of those early machines were not forgiving. You flew by feel and by what the airplane told you through the seat of your pants. Pilots died learning to fly them. Not as an unusual event, but as a predictable one. The mortality rate in European aviation training during and after the Great War was high enough that it was simply part of the landscape. Bessie Coleman stayed the course. She earned her Fédération Aéronautique Internationale license on June 26, 1921. She was the first African-American woman and the first woman of Native American descent to earn a pilot's license anywhere in the world. She was 29 years old. She was not done with Europe. She stayed on for additional training in France and Germany, learning aerobatics and precision flying. She understood that a license was a beginning. To build toward the school she had in mind, she needed to be a performer. She needed to be spectacular enough that people would pay to come watch. When Bessie Coleman returned to the United States, the plan was in two parts that were really one plan in sequence. Part one was to barnstorm, to perform at air shows, to become famous enough that crowds would show up in numbers. Part two was to use the money, the platform, and the visibility to open a flight school in America, a school that would be open to everyone regardless of race or sex. Those were not separate goals. They were the same goal, staged. Her first major public air show appearance in the United States was in the summer of 1922 at Curtis Field on Long Island, New York. 25,000 people came to watch.
25,000 people stood on that Long Island grass and watched Bessie Coleman fly loops and figure eights and low passes. She was precise. She was fearless. She had what the old barnstormers called nerve, which is different from recklessness. Recklessness is when you do not know or do not care what might happen. Nerve is when you know exactly what might happen and you do it anyway because the flying demands it. The newspapers called her Queen Bess. The name stuck immediately and permanently. Now here's where it gets interesting. She barnstormed across the country. Texas, California, Georgia, Florida, Illinois. She flew at fairs and community events and air shows. She spoke at churches and schools and community organizations in between. She was not just selling tickets, she was recruiting. She wanted young Black Americans and women of every background to look up at that airplane and understand that the cockpit was not someone else's seat. She was the proof that it was reachable, and she was not willing to pay any price for that message. When promoters in her home state wanted her to perform at segregated events, separate entrances, separate grandstands for white and Black attendees, Bessie Coleman refused. She walked away from the money. In the 1920s in the South, walking away from a paying engagement over principle cost more than just the fee. It cost you relationships, future bookings, and access to events. She walked away anyway. The condition was reportedly non-negotiable at every show she agreed to do. There would be no separate gates. Her audience came in together or she did not fly. Think for a moment about the machine she was working with out there on the barnstorming circuit. The airplanes were mostly military surplus, Curtis Jennys that had flooded the civilian market after the war ended. The Jenny, the Curtis JN-4, had been the primary American training aircraft of World War I. Gentle and slow and fundamentally stable, it was a good machine for what it was designed to do, but the surplus machines being bought up in the early 20s had been sitting in fields and warehouses. The engines were old. The fabric was faded and sometimes rotted. Maintenance was done when money allowed, which was not always often. Barnstormers were not flush.
Accidents were common. Deaths were common. The barnstorming era is remembered with genuine romance. The gold standard of early American flight, the daredevils and the barnstormers and the wingwalkers. The romance is real, so is the body count. Bessie Coleman knew the risks. She flew anyway. In April of 1926, she was in Jacksonville, Florida. She was preparing for an air show scheduled for May 1st to benefit the Negro Welfare League of Jacksonville. She was planning to make a parachute jump. Her mechanic and publicity manager, William Wills, had flown a Curtis JN-4D down from Texas for the show. Wills was also going to fly the aircraft during the exhibition. On April 30th, 1926, Bessie Coleman climbed into the forward cockpit for a test flight.
She was not wearing a seatbelt. She needed to lean out over the side of the cockpit to scout the ground below, to look for a suitable landing area for her parachute jump the following day. Wills was flying from the rear cockpit. At approximately 1,500 feet, the aircraft entered an abrupt spin. It went over Bessie Coleman and was thrown from the cockpit. She died before the airplane hit the ground. William Wills died in the crash. The investigation found a wrench in the control mechanism, a wrench that had been used during maintenance and had not been removed before the flight. Whether it was there through carelessness or through something more deliberate, the inquiry could not say with certainty. The maintenance history of that airplane was poor by any standard. The wrench may have been a simple fatal oversight. She was 34 years old. She never opened the school. The morning after the crash, a group of aviators from Jacksonville flew over the site in formation. Ida B. Wells, the great journalist and civil rights activist, attended her funeral in Chicago. 10,000 people lined the streets. Robert Abbott's Chicago Defender ran the story on its front page and called her death a national loss. And here is the part of the story that I keep turning over. Bessie Coleman did not get to open her flight school, but the young people who had seen her fly, who had read about her in the Defender, who had heard her speak at their churches and schools, those people did not forget. The pilots who trained and flew for the United States Army Air Forces in World War II as the first black military aviators in the nation's history, the Tuskegee Airmen. Those men were standing on a foundation that Bessie Coleman helped pour. She demonstrated in the most public and undeniable way possible that the cockpit was not a whites-only enclosure. She was the image before the image of a Tuskegee pilot existed. She was the proof before anyone was looking for proof. In the years after her death, other pilots took up her cause directly. William Powell, a black veteran, dedicated his 1934 book on black aviation to Bessie Coleman and helped establish the Bessie Coleman Aero Club. The seeds she planted kept germinating in 1995. The United States Postal Service put her face on a stamp. Chicago named a street for her. A monument stands at Curtis Field. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, named a learning center in Oklahoma City for her. And every year on April 30th, a group of pilots flies over her grave at Lincoln Cemetery in Chicago and drops flowers from the air. That tradition started in 1931, 5 years after she died. Pilots have been flying over that grave for nearly a century. That is not ceremony. That is memory, sustained by people who understand what she meant. There is a line I have heard many times over the years around the hangars. You have to see it to be it. The first image matters. The first proof matters. When every flight school in America says no, what you need is one woman who crosses an ocean and comes home with a license and puts 25,000 people on their feet on a Long Island field. To show them the sky was never closed, the people who told her no were wrong. She knew it before she proved it. That is the part I keep coming back to. She was 34 years old. She never got to build a school. She changed everything anyway. For the history, I'm drawing on Doris Rich's biography, Queen Bess, Daredevil Aviator, along with research from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. Find more at radiohanger.com. I'm Tail Dragger, Blue Skies.